Be seated, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Shrevenant.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon. It's dinner time at the Castro Neves home. 1987, Viverón Prieto. Small town, hours drive from the capital of Sao Paulo. Little Elio is 11 years old. Sister Cati, a year and a half older. And tonight's dinner conversation is about how father has hired a publicist for little Elio, Americo Teixeira, a young journalist who is going to embark upon a campaign to publicize the promising career of little Elio. Cati, the older sister, asks, "Mom, Dad, why all the attention for little Elio?" "Well, Cati, of course this is in Portuguese, your brother has a gift. I see a gift, I see a talent, I see a skill in your brother that few other kids have. Cati, I've been running a stock car team. You know, Corpal, the stock car team, honey, that we take on the weekends and we watch the races. But your brother, he has something more special than these pro drivers have. He's got the gift. And if we devote our family energies, resources, time, effort, towards your brother's career, I think he's going to make it. Your mother believes he's going to make it. Cati, we need you to believe he's going to make it. And I know, Cati, that you know that we love you just the same. You know we love the two of you equally. But understand that we have a once in a lifetime opportunity here to cultivate the skill of your brother, and we're gonna make him the greatest driver of all time. And so when I sell a piece of property in Rio and all the money goes to Elio, please understand, it's not because I love Elio more than I love you. It's not because I favor your brother Elio, but it's because the family's future is now going to be tied to Elio. Cati, join us in this endeavor. I know you love to dance ballet, and I've sent you off for a 6-month training, but we are going to devote the family resources to this promise, to this potential. Please join us. In some homes, that might breed contempt. In some homes, that might breed jealousy. In some homes, that might breed sibling rivalry. But in Viverón Prieto, in 1987, when father hired a public relations professional for an 11-year-old boy, Sister Cati understood. And she understood it was not because they loved him more or because they favored him more, but she understood the family was in a venture. Not much different than many families in our country's history. We forget that we come from a time where, before the Industrial Revolution, families lived on farms here in this country. Siblings worked on the family farm. Parents worked with children. That has changed much since the Industrial Revolution, and even more so since the internet age. Your child goes away at the age of 17 and maybe he'll write, forgive me, maybe he'll send you an email. Maybe he'll pick up the phone, but texting is easier. "Mom, everything is fine. Hope to see you at spring break." That wasn't the model in Viverón Prieto in 1987. And in 1988 and 1989 and 1990, a sister devoting herself to the career of a brother, sacrificing herself for her brother, because she could see in him what her parents saw in him, what everybody else saw in him, what every Brazilian witness we brought to you from Brazil who stayed at that hotel in Dadeland after being flown here at our expense to have a few meals on the US 1 corridor so they could spend a few minutes with you to tell you what they saw in little Elio. Americo Teixeira, the publicist. When he sat on that witness stand in front of you, he was sitting right over here, right here in this chair. And he looked across the courtroom, and he didn't see a 33-year-old man from Dancing with the Stars, red carpets, ESPY Awards. No, he didn't see that man. He saw this boy. This is the boy he saw, sitting there. And in a genuine show of emotion, a grown man, Americo Teixeira, he wept because that's who he saw. And that's the boy that older sister Kati has sought to support, protect, assist, her whole life. She has dedicated her life to her brother. A sister dedicating her life to her brother. And so she understood that this was the promise of a future for a family. This was not a hobby. Dad wasn't going to quit working at Corpal so little Elio could pursue the hobby of racing around a go-kart track as a weekend folly. No, no, this was serious business. And for a sister to understand that, she of course understood, as I've said, that there was more to this than favoritism and love. This was about developing, cultivating, pursuing a special gift that Elio had so that one day they would all share in his success. And if I fast forward 15 years, Elio makes his sister a partner in her company. He makes his father a partner in his earnings. And as Mr. Black said, little Elio at that dinner table didn't sign a contract. He didn't have to. He didn't have Kati sign a contract when she moved to Sao Paulo to live on the sofa of a friend who testified, Marina Salas, so that she could pick up the phone over and over again and call potential sponsors, companies, asking them to sponsor brother Elio. Marlboro, listen, I've got a kid, my brother. He's a fantastic driver. Can I come over? I have publicity materials that I've been cutting and pasting. We've been trying to put together a public relations campaign. We would like you to support Elio. You see, up to now, Father has been dedicating all of his resources.
Objection to the amended conversation, Your Honor.
Overrule.
You heard the testimony. You heard the testimony from the witnesses who did the cutting and pasting and made the phone calls with Kati. I didn't have him talk about all 100 calls where the phones were hung up on him and the doors were slammed in his face, but I'm sure we all understand how it works. And there was Kati knocking on doors, making the phone calls, doing what she could, living in someone else's apartment. You see, the family, as you heard, had to sell all of their assets by 1995, 96. The family had no more assets. All of father and mother's retirement gone, vanished, lawsuits being filed by Caixa Bank, one of the financial institutions that had once sponsored LEO and then made father sign promissory notes and then sought to lien all the property, foreclose the property, whatever the right phrase is. But there was Sister Cotty working hour after hour, day after day in Sao Paulo, Brazil, hours from her home for her brother. And you heard that for that 100th call, they got one sponsor. The Marlboro Company gave them $10,000 to sponsor Elio. 100 doors slammed in her face, 100 phones hung up on, 100 people who said they were too busy to meet with her. And this was the life of Cotty Castroneves, as you heard from the witness stand. Elio goes off to England when father has to mortgage everything and pay the Paul Stewart racing team. And you heard the numbers are staggering. Hundreds of thousands of dollars to run a go-kart team over 4 or 5 years. $250,000 for a Formula Chevrolet team. $400,000 for a Formula 3 team. More than that to send your son to England. Then find sponsors so that Elio can race at Indy Lights. Cotty, please join us. Please join us in this venture to make your brother who he will be one day. Please join us. Is this a Little League baseball team that father is sponsoring? Are these dance lessons as characterized by IRS agent Joanne Levitt? I have for you the testimony of the IRS agent witness who testified before you. It's going to be hard to read. I will read it to remind everybody the view of the IRS in this case from that witness stand. She was asked, is it also true that anyone can pay a person who has done that so that they can recover the cost that they have expended promoting your career? You recall the context about whether Elio could pay father to reimburse father for the expenses father had paid on Elio's behalf. And here is the answer of our IRS witness. My answer to that is that, first of all, that promoting a child, whatever the child is doing, that's what all parents do. We pay for their dance lessons. We pay for their Little League. We pay for tutors. We pay for music lessons. If the child one day excels in one of those areas and then pays us money, that's not necessarily payment for our services. Question. Ma'am, I want you to assume, well, first of all, you heard the testimony here during direct examination, that there are a lot of father and sons that are in the business of racing, correct? Answer, I heard some mention during direct testimony, yes. Okay, and this is not taking somebody to a dance recital. This is millions of dollars at stake. Isn't that right? There was an interruption. Ma'am, when we left off, I asked you, is it a fact that someone selling their assets and paying millions of dollars to promote a career is not the same thing as paying for one's child to have ballet lessons on Saturday? Isn't that true? And she begrudgingly had to admit, yeah, that's not true. And so if the assumption is that the person who has done these services in the past and who has laid out this testimony is the person who's benefited from Seven, isn't it fair to say that a payment to Seven would therefore be deductible? You still couldn't say it. Not necessarily. You say no, you said not necessarily. And it isn't also fair to say that a payment directly to that person would be deductible. Her answer was, I would have to see the purpose of the payment. To repay a parent for prior money expended is not necessarily and generally not a business expense. Little League and dance lessons. Question. I am asking you to assume that it's just simply payment for services rendered. Isn't it a fact that it is deductible? Answer. Payment for businesses, excuse me, for services rendered in a trade or business are deductible expenses. And so the IRS agent who summarized the case for the government tries to characterize what this family did as the equivalent of dance lessons and buying T-shirts and baseball bats for the local Little League team. And you see, that defines the whole case. Because every witness that talked about Elio's career, who knows about racing, not Joanne Levitt, who spends her whole time going through papers and criticizing how people do their taxes, that's her job, take a look at the tax return and criticize how people do it, find fault in how people calculate the taxes, has no experience at all in this profession of race car driving, but the people who know, the Amir Nassers who testified, even the accountants who testified, and we'll talk more about them. Anybody who knows the business knows this is not a hobby that the family was embarking on, and surely Kati didn't believe that when she sacrificed herself and watched her parents spend all of the family money, not on both kids equally, but on one kid more than the other, she understood this was about business. Our government says there's no corroboration for Dad's services. We didn't bring you receipts and contracts of sufficient amount to justify anything. Let me ask the government this question. Who did pay for all of the work and all of the money that was needed to make Elio a professional race car driver? Our evidence shows that it was Father. What's the government's theory as to who paid for it? Everybody knows it was Father. There's no alternative theory that the government has offered you. We bring you facts, we bring you witnesses, and of course these people who come from Brazil love Elio and love Kati, and therefore have a bias in favor of them. The whole town has a bias in favor of Elio and Kati. But what does that tell you about what they went through to develop those kinds of relationships, where simple people from a simple town will fly all the way here to corroborate that it was Father who did all of the work, spent all of the money, financed all of Elio's career? They understood and told you this is not a hobby, this is a business. Nobody in their right mind would spend every dollar of the family wealth on a hobby. Now the government says, well, maybe it's a loan, because Father used the word debt. A loan is when you give somebody money and they pay you back regardless of the outcome, regardless of whether the venture is a success. You borrow money to make an investment, you make a bad investment, the bank wants their money back. You borrow money to buy a car, the car gets wrecked, they want your money back. This wasn't a loan to Elio. This wasn't, here, Elio, take $1.5 million and then pay me back over the next 10 years. No, no. This was a business, joint venture, partnership, family endeavor. Elio wasn't going to be borrowing the money and then paying it back based on a loan. He was paying it back because he was getting services, because he was going to share in the success. If Elio didn't make it, ladies and gentlemen, the family would be ruined. If Elio hadn't made it, the family would be ruined. When someone makes you a loan, the bank wants collateral. They put a mortgage on your home when they give you a loan. They want credit reports. This was not a loan. I think that's fairly clear. You don't lend your child money. No, you take the money and you invest it in your child because you know he's going to be a success, and that's exactly what this family did. And you advance the cost because you expect that, God willing, he's going to make it. And he did. And so we brought you the corroboration that Father did all of the services. We brought you Americo Teixeira, Eduardo de Homem Melo, Jose Maria da Costa, the attorney who accompanied Father on promotion ventures during the years of 2000 through 2004. You heard about investments made by Father for Elio's benefit in Burger King franchises. This is real work. We brought you Amir Nasser. This man walked into the courtroom and he told you that it was father who, on behalf of his son, put together the racing team with the Nasser Castro Nevis stock car. No one will help you with that. Mr. Nasser testified that the value of having the Castro Nevis racing name on the side of the car in the year 2004 was measured in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. All throughout Brazil on the Globo network, Globo, you heard, is like Fox, ABC, CBS, a major network in Brazil. Father negotiated a deal to promote the name Castro Nevis. You don't need to see a receipt for that one, ladies and gentlemen. You've got it in the biggest motor racing magazine. The publisher testified from the witness stand. That business savvy that father brought to the table to the benefit of the Castro Nevis brand is corroborated beyond any doubt. And so I submit to you that the evidence is overwhelming that father provided services for his son, both before Elio signed for Castro Nevis, for Penske Racing, and after Elio signed for Castro Nevis Racing. Mr. Dwyer wants to criticize that father didn't find any sponsors between 2000 and 2004, but you heard the testimony that after 2000, the focus was on promoting the brand name Castro Nevis, what you see on the screen. Finally, they didn't need sponsors for Elio to drive. By now, you know this racing business as well as anybody. Up until 1999, November, father, Elio, sister, mother had to find the money to pay for Elio to drive. But starting in 2000 with the Penske team, the dream came true, and Elio was able to drive without having to pay to drive. And how much is it worth? How much were the services that father provided worth? How much would Elio have had to pay Emerson Fittipaldi for those services? How much did he pay Emerson Fittipaldi for those services? 20% of Elio's income for the 98 season with Consul went to Emerson Fittipaldi. Defense Exhibit 235, the bank records of Elio Castro Nevis, the money from the sponsorship of Consul. Take a look how much money Emerson Fittipaldi's company, Fittipaldi USA, made in 1998, it's right on the screen, $177,000, not to mention Elio's obligation to pay him a percentage of prize money and salary, etc. Father was making less per year than Emerson Fittipaldi. The government has added up all the money. Over the 5 years in question, Emerson Fittipaldi getting paid more than Elio was asked by his father to pay father. Let's take a look at the law on this issue. And the law will come from Judge Graham. There are two pages of the jury instructions I'm going to ask that you focus on. Please make sure that everybody can see that. We're talking now about the deductibility of payments made to father. What is the law? When can a taxpayer deduct payments made for services, even if those services are rendered by your parent? Of course, there are present services and past services, services that are being done currently and services that have been done in the past. And the law says, as Judge Graham will instruct you, that a taxpayer may also deduct payments during a taxable year for services rendered by his or her parent in a prior tax year if the parent has personally provided significant and valuable services for the taxpayer in the past. The taxpayer and his parent previously agreed that the taxpayer would pay back his or her parent for the past services. There is evidence to verify that the taxpayer and his parent agreed at a definite point years earlier that the taxpayer would pay back his parent for those past services. And finally, that the money the taxpayer paid his or her parent for the past services is for a reasonable amount, as judged by the amount of time the parent dedicated to providing services for the taxpayer, the amount of income he lost by not working so he could provide services to the taxpayer, and then the final element, which I find most telling, and the uncertainty that the parent would ever be paid, the risk that the parent took. Of course, at the bottom, the court clarifies that money the taxpayer sends his parents as a gift or repayment of a loan cannot be deducted. But I think it's relatively clear by now, these weren't gifts that Elio was making to his father. His father was working, and his father had worked. It wasn't a loan, as we just discussed. So under the law, at page 25 of the jury instructions that you will get, page 25, the law says that as long as father provided the services, Elio had agreed he was going to pay his father, the amount is reasonable, it's a deductible expense. And that makes sense. It just makes sense. What difference does it make whether it's his father doing the service or if it was, to use Roy's example, Mike Tyson paying Don King to do those services? What difference does it make who it is? Of course, Don King would charge more. But what difference does it make that Fittipaldi would charge more? These are reasonable payments for services rendered. And then the next page, page 26 of your jury instructions, for present services for 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003 and 2004, if Elio pays his father necessary and ordinary expenses, including reasonable payments for present services actually rendered during that taxable year. So I ask, who was running the campaign in Brazil for Elio while Elio was racing for Penske? Who was responding to the hundreds and hundreds of media inquiries by the Brazilian press? Portuguese language articles, just a sample, hundreds and hundreds per year. Let me see, this is 2001 sampling. Who's responding to the social magazine calls? Hey, we'd like to have a story about Elio. Can we get a comment? Or, hey, listen, we'd like to have Elio appear in Caras magazine. Can, whatever. They know the name, I can't pronounce it. Who was in charge? Who's running the website in Brazil? Penske wasn't running his website. The Penske witnesses told you, no. All promotion efforts of a personal nature in Brazil, that's the driver's responsibility. Well, if it wasn't his father who was running it, what's the government's theory? Who do they think was running Elio's public relations campaign in Brazil? Who was directing Marina Lima? That's a name you may not recall, but the receipts that Joanne Levitt recognized as public relations payments by father. Who was directing her work? Who was making the decisions there? Who had the business savvy? Who was, let me think. Let me ask my government. Who put this deal together? I wonder who put this deal together. I'm getting carried away and I apologize. Because the answer is so simple. And so under the law, it's all perfectly proper to pay for the services of someone who's working for you, even if it's your father. Did the accountants know that father was providing services? Were there any secrets being kept from the accountant? Well, this is the government's chart, Government Exhibit 372. The government's chart. They prepared it. If you go to Government Exhibit 109, it says that father's getting a $50,000 payment for professional expenses. Government Exhibit 373. Wire transfer, Pi, Brazil. We all know what Pi means by now. It's father. Brazil expenses, HPZ, father account. Mother's account. And by the way, these are all those Dolaro transactions. The government brought us a witness to talk about the Doleros, and you can choose to use a bank and pay the higher exchange rate, or you can do it through the Dolaro and save some money by doing it that way. This argument that it's done to conceal or to avoid a paper trail, all the money gets deposited right in father and mother's accounts. It's traced right there. The government's got it all because the father just deposits the money. But of course, why pay extra commission if you don't have to? Father, 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 and father. How many times do the accountants need to be told that it's father before they will admit that it was father? I asked Jill Combs, the accountant, the one that received a target letter. I said, Ms. Combs, here's the worksheet. There it is. From your accounting records. There's the Larson bait stamp. And they just go blind. The accountants went blind in this courtroom. And Roy has addressed that. A target letter can blind you. The fear of prison can blind them. The fear of our government accusation can blind them. I'm going to take a detour because this seems to be the right time to show you an exhibit that has nothing to do with these expenses, but has everything to do with who you can believe or not believe. Remember Shirley, Mr. Miller's accountant? She gave us that lesson on word processing and computers and all of that. I think I called Mr. Miller a dinosaur, but she agreed. She's the one who sent this 13-page fax to those accountants. Remember, we went through it painfully. I had to go page by page to prove to you that these accountants got 13 pages. One of 13, everybody's looking at the top right corner, two of 13, three of 13, four, five, six, seven, eight, and then it stopped. The accounting firm, who according to Shirley was sent all of these pages, can't seem to locate the promotional representation agreement. Nobody called Shirley to say, hey, the fax machine ran out of paper or the machine jammed. But of course, we know it didn't jam because this print shows that the accounting firm got the document. Now, of course, the fax machine over at the Larson firm didn't get a target letter. See, the fax machine wasn't worried about going to prison. So the fax machine has no reason to tell a lie, has no reason to be blind, because the fax machine's not afraid. This is the best evidence that when the government scares the daylights out of a professional, they go blind. We'll get back to this concept. So who was raising the sponsorships? Consul, Hudson, Brahma Beer, Marlboro, Caixa, it was Father, and it was Kati. When Elio moves to the United States, and in 1999, he's driving for the Hogan team. By now, everybody knows that the Hogan team wasn't getting the sponsorship money that Emerson Fittipaldi had promised. So we're now in February of 1999. During the 98 season, I think Kati was at a desk at Fittipaldi's office in Brazil. She was living with Fittipaldi's secretary. She came and testified, Eloisa Acevedo and her daughter, Renata Pepe. Eloisa, lovely lady who said, look, I heard Kati was short on funds, living in a cramped apartment with a girlfriend. I invited her to my home to live with me and my daughter. And Kati was working the phones trying to raise sponsorships for her brother. And in 1999, Hogan signs Elio, conditioned upon Emerson Fittipaldi producing $1 million guarantee, $3 million in sponsorship. He comes up empty. Where are we going to get the money? Father does what father has always done. He goes to work for his son. He and Kati work together, and they find a sponsor for Elio. Elio wasn't knocking on doors in March of 1999. He was racing in the United States for the Hogan team. He wasn't working the phones. He wasn't knocking on doors. He wasn't traveling down to Brazil. He was driving the race car. And father puts together the deal with Coimex. Father signs the deal on behalf of Elio. Elio later signs the contract a few months later in May of 99 at the Rio race. But as Mr. Black has already explained to you, once again, it was father that found the sponsor. And like with Consul, when Consul sent the money to the United States, remember these transfers to Bettenhausen in the 98 season? When the money from a sponsor comes in to Elio Castroneves' account, immediately it goes out to the race team, to whoever keeps the money. In this case, according to the contract that Elio signed that was prepared by attorney Correa, it was Seven Promotions, a company that attorney Correa and father set up in March of 99 because father was trying to protect his assets from CaixaBank. Father was trying to protect his assets from Emerson Fittipaldi. And of course, Roy has explained to you, this case is not about father. It's about son Elio and daughter Catiusia. How father managed his affairs is not the issue in the case. The question is, how did Elio and Kati manage their affairs? And Elio did what Elio had always done. He drove, and when father sent him $50,000, he used it so he could drive. It was reported on his tax return, all taxes paid in accordance with the tax laws. The government doesn't want to seem to accept the concept of licensing rights. Mr. Garvin spent a few minutes. I want to spend a few minutes with you talking about it. It's an important point in this case because Government's Exhibit 6 is the licensing agreement prepared by Attorney Correa, signed eventually by Elio Castroneves. And what is the issue with a licensing agreement? It's no different, as Roy may have mentioned, when Mike Tyson signs with Don King. Don King is the promoter. He owns Mike Tyson's rights. When Mike Tyson gets into that ring, if Don King owns his rights, Don King decides how much money Mike Tyson gets paid. We use him as an example. It happens with athletes all the time. But the concept of licensing rights, it's different than the driving. It's now the name, fame, and likeness. It's that Nike commercial, if you hit it big one day like Michael Jordan did. People make more money off their licensing rights than they do off their salaries as players. We all know that. Just the other day we had the Sony Ericsson tennis tournament here. I always think about Anna Kournikova. She's never won a tournament. Never won a tournament in professional tennis. All of her income has been made from licensing. Hey, in America, we love television, we love magazines, People Magazine, maybe more than Time Magazine, Us Magazine, maybe more than Newsweek. But there is a value to your image. Of course, in 1999, there wasn't much of a value to Elio's image. But in any event, father went to work for son again to raise money. And it was clear now that if father was going to put more time, invest more of his resources, it was time that father needed to get paid back. And you know what? Let's make sure that we don't get all caught up in words and language. This is not a prosecution based on words or nomenclature or choice of words. I just said so father could get paid back. I hope our government doesn't jump up and say, see, that means it's a loan. Let's understand that although words are important, reality is more important, the reality of the situation. I say paid back because when father expends the money and does the service, he wants to get paid. He's not getting paid today. Later, he's going to get paid back. And so forgive me if my choice of words is imperfect. Understand the reality of the transaction. So now we're in 1999, it's March. Father goes to work for son. Sister comes up from Brazil to help brother. And indeed, we'll fast forward in a moment to Fontana, California, where sister is in Fontana on that fateful Halloween Sunday, October 31. So who owns 7 in March of 1999? Why would Elio be the owner of 7? What value does 7 have at that point? All it has is a contract with Coimex. Who got the contract with Coimex? Father. Whose signature is all over the documents? Father. Who does Osiris Leite Correa, the attorney who put the company together, who does he say owns 7 Promotions? This was the first document that was introduced in the defense case. The government chose not to introduce it. It's a stipulation of the parties, and let me explain. Let's take a look at the last page of this stipulation. It's a document that was signed by the parties, including the government attorney, on February 6th of 2009. That was before we met you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. That was before this trial. That was pre-trial. And by February 6th of 2009, what did our government know? It knew that Attorney Correa, by stipulation, that means the government agreed this is his testimony. The government agrees that if Osiris Leite Correa were to testify at trial, he would tell you that it was father who hired Correa to form 7 Promotions to commercially exploit the image of Elio Castroneves, and that it was father who was the person whom Correa, the attorney, would have contacted if the attorney needed to speak to someone concerning 7 Promotions. What else would Correa have testified to, as the government was well aware as of February 6th, before the trial? What was the government aware of? That Correa had contacted a Panamanian lawyer named Mr. Burguito. You all met Mr. Burguito. And that 7 Promotions was incorporated as a bearer share, which means that whoever has physical possession of the shares owns the company. And here's the key language. This is the man who formed the company. The man who formed the company, the attorney Correa, had the clear understanding that it was father who was the owner of Seven Promotions. After all, Correa formed the company. Mr. Correa also reviewed the COIMEX contract, so Mr. Correa knew exactly what the purpose of Seven was. And it was to cover Elio's expenses. That it was Kevin Savory, the accountant, in a meeting in May of 2000 that made all these suggestions regarding tax issues. It wasn't Elio's idea or Adi's idea. It was Savory's idea, a tax accountant trying to give advice. This is Miller Exhibit Number 1, I believe, in case the jury would like to see it later in the case. It was also Mr. Correa's understanding that father was the owner of Chalfont's Trade Corporation. And so we have the testimony stipulated to by the government regarding attorney Correa. Now, attorney Correa does say that he received the stock of Seven Promotions from Mr. Burguido, and that at some point, not specified by Mr. Correa, he turned the stock over to father. I'm going to try to find that for you. I'll make it easier for myself. I'll let Noah try to find it for me. And so, the best evidence in the case. Who owned Seven Promotions? Roy pointed out all of the facts. Who was signing? Who was running the money? But I would just add, who's the lawyer who formed the company, and what did he say? He told you who owned Seven. And so, Elio continues to drive for Hogan. It all ends at the road in Fontana. The Hogan team is going to collapse. There is no more Hogan team. Elio is going to be without a car to drive. And then, of course, the Greg Moore accident. And that sparks a series of events which are summarized in this timeline. We have Greg Moore passing away on the 31st, Penske reaching out to Elio to drive. We have the negotiations beginning between Alan Miller on behalf of Elio, only after Mark Seiden, the attorney in Miami, recommends Mr. Miller. All the drafting, all the redlining. And by now, we all know what redlining is and cutting and pasting and all of that. It's all done in this one week. This is a week when Alan Miller has just lost a friend, Greg Moore. Alan Miller's wife is pregnant. A month later, she gives birth to the name of the son. Middle name is Greg. Alan Miller has to go to the funeral of Greg Moore on that Wednesday, come back on that Thursday, and get through these documents in time for the signing that Penske wants to do on Friday. Now, Roy showed you the document from the Greg Moore contract where all that language was written in by Fred Feingold. So you know that Fred Feingold, the tax attorney, was involved in the structure of the Greg Moore deal? There's no testimony that Alan Miller actually ever studied the Greg Moore language. Fred Feingold sent the changes to Shirley. There's no evidence that Alan Miller studied the Elio Castroneves documents carefully. After all, he had just gotten back from the funeral
These contracts have already been approved in substance by the pension side. If the $6 million contract, Elio would have driven for a fraction of that. Indeed, he would have probably driven for free just to get in the Penske car so he could win races. But let's assume he wouldn't ride for free. Let's just assume he would have ridden for what he got paid the year before by Hogan, $250,000. Now we're talking about a three-year, $6 million deal. Mark Seiden gets the contract on a Thursday night, and he tells you that he starts reading the contract, all of his legalese, some 30-some-odd pages, and the contracts are signed the next day. Okay, so the contracts are signed, and it certainly appears that an honest mistake was made. And the government says, well, no one tried to correct the mistake. Mr. Dwyer wrote, nobody corrected the public, promotional representation agreement. Well, of course, the correction was made in the form of that letter by Alan Miller on December 15 to stop the payment to Seven Promotions. Paragraph 6, the bearer shares of Seven Promotions were delivered to Elio Phidias Zeglis de Castroneves, but Mr. Correa doesn't say when. The government says, well, why would Elio Castroneves send money to a company he doesn't know? But the government is making a huge assumption. They are assuming that Elio Castroneves read 40-some-odd pages of English text, understood the impact of the language that $5 million was going to be going to Seven Promotions, understood the significance of all of that that Friday morning when he signed on the dotted line where the sticky was. I submit to you that given the facts of this case, you know that Elio didn't read it, Mr. Seiden didn't explain it to him, Alan Miller didn't explain it to him, but in December, a meeting took place and a decision was made that the responsible thing to do was to stop the payment and structure this deal in accordance with a deferred royalty or a retirement account. And that was the structure that was suggested by Alan Miller, eventually by other tax professionals, and Mr. Elio Castroneves followed that advice. It bears repeating that under the law that Judge Graham will instruct you, that because Mr. Miller told Penske, don't send the money, this is now going to be a retirement for Elio Castroneves. He understands that, Mr. Miller understands that, and the communication is given to the Penske Corporation, hold the payment. Page 20 of your jury instructions to the top of page 21. If a taxpayer requests deferral of income prior to receiving an unconditional vested right to the income, the taxpayer has not constructively received it. Even the IRS tax expert, Joanne Levin, I asked her, it took 2 or 3 years to get all this thing done with FinTaz and Fortis Bank, all having nothing to do with Elio. The tax professionals couldn't get it all squared away. Her thinking is that if this constructive receipt comes about, she admits that if it all could have been done by December of 99, we wouldn't even have heard of the term constructive receipt because it's before January when the payment becomes due. But I guess her position is that because it took 3 years to get this done through no fault of Elio, and I think Attorney Lily Sanchez took you through all the documents. You have them there, Lily? Yeah. She took us through those documents, which explained, according to the people at FinTaj, here it is, right here, paragraph number 9. The delay was from a difficulty in securing a guarantee from Fortis Bank or other banks. It was due to the amount of the fee FinTaj wanted, et cetera, et cetera. Paragraph 9 of the stipulation.
This has nothing to do with Elio Castroneves.
By this time, you have to remember, December of 1999, he's told, Penske's holding the money, let the lawyers deal with all of this. Now, by the way, is Penske really holding the money? No, no. Penske is spending the money. They didn't put it aside in a separate account for Elio. Wasn't segregated. Elio understood, okay, this is a retirement situation. Alan Miller is handling it. He's the premier racing lawyer in our country. And at the moment, Penske's responsible.
Sounds reasonable. And so he went back doing his trade, doing his business, understanding it would be taken care of. But even as Roy told you, a couple years later when things hadn't been worked out, he goes to see Nelson Schlossberg as the other attorney, just to find out, someone explain to me what's going on. 2 years, I don't understand what's taking so long for all of this to be done. And the lawyers are trying to do their best to get it done. And so that should be the end of the case on the Penske issue. Let's take a look at the instructions. This is from page 16 of the jury instructions. There are three elements to convict somebody of tax evasion. We're not talking now about a civil case. We're not talking about an audit, how much do you owe, etc. No, we're talking about criminal liability, criminal conviction, criminal consequences. That's what we're here about, not an audit. The first element before you're going to convict somebody of a criminal tax case is to determine that they owed a substantial income tax. You know from the instruction at the bottom of page 20, Elio doesn't owe any money on the Penske aspect because the money wasn't paid to him and it wasn't constructively received by him because the stop payment precedes January 1, 2000. So we don't even get past the first element. Now, there are two other elements to a criminal tax case. Because even if there is a taxpayer that you find owes taxes, let's assume that you were a jury in a criminal tax case where hey, it looked like the taxes are owed. Hey, the guy got the $5 million. He took the $5 million. He spent the $5 million and didn't pay his taxes. Let's assume that was the case, that Elio had actually gotten the money. He spent the money, he enjoyed the money, none of which happened in this case. Elio still hasn't seen the money. We're in the year 2009, he still hasn't gotten the money. The government wants to collect the tax on it, but he hasn't gotten it yet. But let's assume that a taxpayer gets the money. Let's assume that. In a criminal case, it wouldn't be enough that you find that the taxpayer got the money and needed to pay the tax on it. That would not be enough in a criminal case, because there's two other elements the judge will explain. The taxpayer not only would have to owe the tax, but that the taxpayer took, number one, knowingly and willfully attempted to evade or defeat the payment of tax, and then third, committed an affirmative act in furtherance of that objective. One thing I don't want you to be confused about is the conspiracy instruction. Because to be guilty of a conspiracy, there are four elements. You're only guilty of a conspiracy if you conspire to do something that's illegal. You conspire to commit tax evasion. If what you, quote, conspire to do is to minimize your taxes lawfully, that's not a conspiracy. If I get together with my accountant and I say, hey, how do I structure my affairs so that I can pay only as much tax as the law requires, not a penny more? See, a conspiracy to pay the least amount of tax that the law allows, not a criminal conspiracy. Because as the judge will instruct you at page 24 of the jury instructions, this is in your jury instructions at page 24, a taxpayer is at complete liberty to decrease his or her taxes or avoid them altogether
by means which the law permits. So I want to make sure that nobody walks away from this courtroom thinking that if I get together with my lawyer and my accountant to discuss the way to pay the least amount of taxes, that it's a crime, that it's a conspiracy. It is not. And so over the next couple of years, after he signs with the Penske team, Kathy is now working with her brother. The two of them have formed a little company here called Castroneves Racing that Alan Miller had set up. Elio is racing. The accountants and the lawyers are trying to work these things out to get the Fintage situation. And let's be clear about what Fintage is. And you have Feingold's opinion. I'm not going to, as boring as I am, the Feingold opinion is even more boring, all those tax issues. But when a taxpayer agrees to have money go to a company like Fintage, Fintage is not owned by the taxpayer. The money that goes to Fintage as part of the Penske deal belongs to Fintage until such time as the retirement period kicks in, then money gets paid to the taxpayer. If Fintage goes broke and Fortis Bank doesn't honor its guarantee, Elio is out of luck. He doesn't get a dime. All those people from General Motors who have all their money invested in a 401k with General Motors. You say, hey, I put my money in General Motors 401k. Where's my money? Well, I'm sorry to tell you, it's been invested by our investment experts, and they were able to get you a net loss of 80% of your retirement. Congratulations. Now, Mr. Black made the point. Do we really know who these investment professionals are when we trust our retirement with people, whether it be Bear Stearns, who's now out of business, whether it's Wells Fargo, Citibank, any of these entities? Do we know who these people are? Does Elio know who Fintage is? He just knows what Fred Feingold and the other professionals told him. And he put his trust in these people. And he's trusting that the money will be there to pay him when he retires. And that's when he pays the tax, when he gets the money. There are a few other charges against Elio and Kathy that deal with matters which have been described as not material, the Hugo Boss, the TAM Airlines. Hugo Boss never sent a 1099. That's the form that a company typically sends out to a taxpayer to put them on notice that this constitutes income. You know that the Hugo Boss contract wasn't with Elio, it was with Penske. And there's no evidence whatsoever of any willful attempt to evade the payment of tax with regard to the Hugo Boss clothing allowance that Elio used in order to satisfy his obligation to his employer. And indeed, the testimony from Chave, the tax expert, regarding those issues, explained that it's not necessarily income. Of course, there's an offset if you're using wardrobe for business purposes, and the airline tickets, if Elio is using them to travel to Brazil for work, likewise, there's an offset. It's not a material issue in this case. I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about other law that the judge will instruct you on. You'll
You'll hear a lot from lawyers arguing. You've been hearing from us for 6 weeks.
But what really counts is not the quality of the advocacy, how interesting we were, how interesting the prosecutors were, how good a lawyer any one of us is. What really counts is the law. That's why you're here. Because you don't argue somebody into a criminal conviction. You don't bring the consequences of a criminal conviction on someone because you have a better ability to advocate. You do it because there's evidence and it violates the law. And so we start with the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The highest burden that the law recognizes. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof of such a convincing character that you would be willing to rely upon and act upon it without hesitation in the most important of your own affairs. That's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Do you have reasons to doubt the government's case? Do you have reasons to doubt that Elio Castroneves has to pay taxes on money he didn't get, that he still hasn't gotten, that his lawyer told Penske not to pay? Do you have a reason to doubt on that? Do you have a reason to doubt on the Coimex transactions, where it is eminently clear that Father set this up as a way to, number one, make sure Elio could drive, acquire his licensing rights, Father could recoup expenses he had laid out for Elio over all those years. Elio paid his taxes on the money he got. And how much taxes did he pay over these years? The government says it has no bearing, that he paid well over $1 million over 5 years, but it's the government that told you, I remember an opening statement, he doesn't want to pay his fair share. And Mr. Black explained to you that concept. What Elio doesn't have to do is pay more than his fair share. None of us have to pay more than our fair share. But certainly Elio has paid his fair share of taxes owed on money he has received. Certainly he has paid his fair share. Even if he isn't from this country. Even as the government says, he came to this country looking for the land of opportunity. We all came to this country. We're all foreigners who came to this country. It may not have been this year. It may not have been my generation. It might have been my parents' generation. It might have been our grandparents' generation. But we're all immigrants to this great country. The government says, this is a quote from the closing argument of counsel for the government. You can't tell the company, quote, don't pay me now. This has to do, of course, with the Penske money. I showed you instruction, page 20. The law says you can, and that should end this case. We shouldn't be arguing among lawyers on a point that is so clear in the instruction. Penske keeps the money and the government wants him to pay the tax on it. Penske spends the money and your government wants Elio to pay the tax on it. The government wants to hold him responsible for words like arbitration, allocation, attribution, indemnification, share capital, force majeure, ipso facto, controlled foreign corporations, constructive receipt, shell entities, deductibility, vested rights, conflicts of laws. And let's give him an English dictionary to help him define those terms. The government will surely show you the testimony of Elio and Kotsky in the civil deposition. I expect that the rebuttal will include that testimony for you to evaluate. They said what they knew, and they knew it at the time.
You heard that this was a bearer share company, this company seven.
He who holds the shares owns the shares.
There's a jury instruction on that. It's not just Panamanian law. The judge will explain you it's U.S. law. Page 22 of your jury instructions. And so, father is explaining his understanding, which apparently is consistent with the instruction that as long as Osiris is holding it, Osiris is the owner. But father knew it's father's money. Father was going to want to be the intended owner of this company. But when Tati and Elio were trying to testify, all they know is that Seven is a Panamanian corporation. It had something to do with the COIMEX deal, and they said what they knew, under oath, as they knew it. And their testimony is consistent with the jury instruction, with what Correa said, with what Bergito told you from Panama, and with what father understood. And as long as father or Correa or both of them are the owners of Seven, again, constructive receipt doesn't apply, because if it's not Elio, there's no constructive receipt.
If I may have a moment, Judge. Sometimes I have to count on my brother to help me. Thank you, Scotty.
Scotty reminds me that the law requires the concept of willfulness. In a tax case, the government has to prove that the person acted with a specific purpose to do something the person knows the law forbids.
Did Tati and Elio set out to come to this country to commit a crime? To not pay their taxes? Tati and Elio came to this country to pursue their dream. It was the dream of a father, a dream of a mother, a dream of a son, and the dream of a sister.
A sister who dedicated herself to her brother selfishly, without jealousy, without envy, supporting her brother, without fame, indeed without fortune. She did it because she understood, as I started out this afternoon, she understood the purpose of this endeavor. She knew where it would end. She didn't expect it would end here in this courtroom, though. Rather, she believed in her little brother. And she was there to support him throughout, to protect him. And that's what she's done. Ever since she was that 13-year-old girl at the dinner table in Riva Ron Preto, all she set out to do was protect her brother. And I thought of the movie. A movie about two girls that grow up like sisters. One becomes a famous singer, and the other one living in her shadow. Bette Midler sang the song, you may recall it. The movie was Beaches. It must have been cold there in my shadow to never have sunlight on your face. You were content to let me shine, that's your way. You always walked a step behind. I was the one with all the glory, while you were the one with all the strength. A beautiful face without a name for so long. A beautiful smile to hide the pain. Did you ever know that you're my hero? And everything I would like to be. I can fly higher than an eagle, for you are the wind beneath my wings. Kathy, it might have appeared to go unnoticed, but Elio has you in his heart. He wants you to know the truth. He knows the truth. He would be nothing without you. Did Elio ever tell you that you're his hero? That you're everything. Everything he wishes he could be. He can fly higher than an eagle, because you are the wind beneath his wings. Fly, fly, fly high against the sky. So high, he almost touches the sky. You are the wind beneath his wings, Kati.
Yes, you are.